What a wonderful full house, and how good it is to see all of you. Good evening, and welcome to the third event in the 2019 Leon Panetta Lecture Series. This season, our 22nd year, we've been discussing the system of checks and balances and considering the future of our democracy. At our first event, we discussed the Mueller investigation. Though the investigation is now concluded, there remain significant questions about how the results of the special counsel's report will be shared with the American public. And more importantly, how we can protect our system of elections from further interference. Last month, we turned our focus to the press and their responsibility to bring the truth to the American people, and the Congress as a check and balance on the executive branch. Tonight, we turn our focus to foreign affairs. For the 70 years that followed World War II, America has without question been the leader of the free world. In that leadership role, we have worked closely with our allies in pursuit of economic stability, peace, and the support of the values of Western democracy. That leadership and alliances won the Cold War and spread global prosperity. But globalization has had destabilizing effects. Nationalism and populism have surged, the result of inequality within countries, the dislocation associated with the 2008 financial crisis. Job losses caused by trade and technology increased the flow of migrants and refugees, and the power of social media to spread hate. President Trump speaks of America first and has withdrawn from treaties and agreements to protect what he sees as the best interests of the United States. But the reality is that if the United States failed to win, to lead, no one else will. From Iran to the Middle East, to Venezuela, to North Korea, China, and Russia, the globe is covered in a number of flashpoints that could set off at any minute. Added to these concerns are issues like terrorism, the threat of cyber, climate change, and trade. Can President Trump protect American economic, political, and military security without working collaboratively with our allies? Is he right to question the long-standing liberal global order, or will his actions leave our nation vulnerable and without the support of long-held alliances? And does he have the necessary advice and counsel required to make these vital decisions? Tonight, we'll talk with three experts who know firsthand how volatile and how dangerous the world can be. All three are men with whom Leon worked closely during his work at the CIA and the Department of Defense. They are well-versed in our military capabilities, our diplomatic options, the threats we face, and the unique global leadership role assumed by this president. Our first guest is a retired four-star general and a 45-year Marine veteran who has served and sacrificed on behalf of the interests of the United States from the battlefields of Iraq to the Oval Office. As part of a celebrated military career, he led the multinational force West in Iraq and was later the senior military aide to Defense Secretaries Robert Gates and Leon Panetta. In 2016, he assumed leadership of the United States Southern Command. He was responsible for Guantanamo Bay and all United States military operations in South and Central America, and he focused on border security and regional stability in nations like Venezuela. He worked closely with the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. After less than a year in retirement, He assumed the post of Secretary of Homeland Security and worked on immigration and border security issues. He went on to serve as Chief of Staff for President Donald Trump from July 31, 2017 to January 2, 2019, and made an effort to impose discipline on White House operations. So please welcome General John Kelly.
Thanks, Hillary.
Our second guest has 27 years of diplomatic service, has served under Democratic and Republican presidents, and is considered one of the most distinguished career diplomats of our time. He began his diplomatic service in 1980, working as an intern at the American Embassy in Mauritania. From 1983 to 1985, he was stationed at the American Embassy in Egypt. He went on to work at the American Consulate General in Jerusalem and later served on the National Security Council in the administrations of President George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. During his work on the NSC, he was Director for Soviet Affairs, Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia Affairs, and Special Assistant to President Clinton. In 1995, he was named spokesperson for the U.S. Department of State and was later appointed ambassador to Greece. He served in that post for 4 years before being named ambassador to NATO. Promoted to Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in 2005, he led negotiations on a number of key agreements on nuclear disarmament and was the lead United States negotiator on Iran's nuclear program. So please welcome Ambassador Nick Burns.
Thank you very much. Same spot.
Our third guest is a recognized national authority on United States national security who has advised political leaders on both sides of the aisle, including Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. During his time in the military, he commanded special operations forces at every level, eventually taking charge of the United States Special Operations Command. His career included combat during Desert Storm and both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. He served as the Director for Strategic Planning in the Office of Combating Terrorism on the National Security Council staff. He was Commander of United States Special Operations Command, Staff of the Chief of Naval Operations, and the Chief of Staff at Naval Special Warfare Group 1. He commanded the troops that captured Saddam Hussein, and he also rescued Captain Phillips. He worked closely with Leon when Leon was CIA director on the successful 2011 operation in Abbottabad, Pakistan, that brought Osama bin Laden to justice. Please welcome Admiral William McRaven. Moderating our discussion is the man who created this lecture series, the former congressman for this district, director of the Office of Management and Budget. I love reading this. White House Chief of Staff, director of the CIA, and Secretary of Defense. He's worked closely with each of these men in the effort to protect our nation at home and abroad. So please welcome Leon Panetta.
Good evening and welcome to this, our third forum of the Panetta Lecture Series. Our theme is checks and balances, will our democracy survive? And as you know, we've talked about the rule of law in the presidency. We've talked about the role of free press and the role of the Congress. And tonight, we wanted to focus on the president's role as commander-in-chief and the institutions in our democracy that are intended to check the commander-in-chief, but also to work with the president in protecting our national security. President Ronald Reagan, at the 40th anniversary of the landing at Normandy, defined the role for United States leadership in the world. And there was a quote in his speech that I share with you. It said that the United States never was and never will be an isolationist country. Today, some 35 years after that speech, there's concern about whether or not the United States is withdrawing from its leadership role in the world. Is the old world order over? Are we seeing a major shift in power with China replacing the United States in that position in the 21st century? What are the implications of what's happening today for our role in national security? Those are the issues we'll discuss with this outstanding panel of speakers. All of them, this is a little bit like old home week. I work with each of them. John Kelly was my aide at the Department of Defense, he was a tough Marine then, and I actually trained him for the position of being Chief of Staff.
Thanks.
Nick Burns worked at State Department when I was in the Clinton administration, worked very closely with him. He has always been a tremendous expert in diplomacy. Of course, that guy on the end, Bill McCraven, was the leader on Special Forces that I worked with on the raid on Bin Laden's compound. And he deserves a tremendous amount of responsibility for that leadership. All right, let me begin by just asking a general question here about foreign policy and national security policy. For over 70 years since World War II, the United States has been a leader in the world. We've built alliances. We've had agreements on trade. We've had agreements on arms control. We've worked with international organizations. We have fought alongside our allies, particularly after 9/11. The president has questioned some of these principles, but at the same time, he's also implemented some of the same policies in the sense of sanctions on the Russians and others. He's tried to pursue diplomacy, particularly with North Korea. He's also tried to pull together our forces with regards to fighting ISIS and terrorism. So there are some similar policies that are being put into place. So my question is, what is the foreign policy of the United States today under the Trump administration? Is it America first and the isolationism of the 1930s? Is it totally ad hoc based on whatever his guts tell him this country ought to stand for from crisis to crisis? Or is it a combination of both? A lot of tough talk about change, but at the same time, implementing some of the same policies we've seen in the past. What is the foreign policy of this administration? John?
Well, I'd start by saying, Mr. Secretary, that it is an American first foreign policy. That does not mean, though, and the president's been fairly clear about this, I think, it doesn't mean to the detriment of everybody else. He came certainly from a different world in terms of not being a politician, not being a Washington guy. And when he came in, probably the two driving things is He is bound and determined to set the relationship back on what he would consider to be a more fair footing. So in the case of economics, trade, you know, we have these tremendous trade imbalances with countries like Japan and South Korea and the EU and certainly China, and he wants to fix that. He wants to fix the NAFTA agreement with Mexico, and they've actually come up with a pretty good USMCA, as it's called, agreement that both countries will have to adopt. But it's not necessarily to the detriment of Mexico. It's just in Canada. It's just a better, fairer relationship in terms of national security. He looks at NATO, and at the end of the day, we alongside our NATO allies, have for 70 years or so defended, deterred any action by the old Soviet Union, now Russia. And as I would say many, many times in my dealings with the team at the White House, that deterrence is better than fighting a war any day of the week. And yes, deterrence can be expensive, but it's still better than fighting a war. But as he looked at NATO and the commitments that all NATO countries have made to spend 2% of their GDP as a kind of a target for what they should be spending on their military defense, very few of them have come even close to that, where the United States spends about 4% of GDP on its commitment to NATO. So he's been pretty vocal about, hey, boys and girls, start to work very, and it's been effective. I mean, the first year he was the president, I think purchases went up immediately to the tune of about $100 billion. That's continued. Some of the countries have come in and said, we'll get there, but it'll take us some time. But he's put pressure on them. The other issue, of course, we're in South Korea. We spend a great deal of our own money defending South Korea, and we have a trade imbalance with South Korea, and he wants to fix that. So it's not ad hoc. The one driving principle for sure is fairness, both in the trade area and in the military defense area.
Nick? Well, I think we're now more than 2 years into the Trump presidency. I don't think it's fair to say that there's a Trump doctrine or a really coherent strategy of what he's trying to achieve. He appears to be very passionate, but John would know General Kelly much better about both trade and immigration. I've been a critic, but I think you have to be responsible and say he's done some things well. I think his inclination that you've got to have good head of government relations with the other powers, with President Xi Jinping of China, with President Putin of Russia, maybe not good relations, but at least an open channel, that's correct. I think he was correct about North Korea. A lot of people criticize him for going off to meet Kim Jong-un, but the only American who had met Kim Jong-un before President Trump was a really good basketball player named Dennis Rodman, but probably not the guy you want to negotiate the nuclear weapons future of the world. And the president looked at people like me and said, well, you guys had your chance in the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administration. You'd failed because you did it kind of the bottom up. You didn't get to negotiate with the top leader. This is a dictatorship. Kim Jong-un runs everything. So I thought the president's inclination, let me go meet him, let me take his measure, let me see if he's serious, it made sense to me. That's good. I think he's been very tough on China, trade, and he needs to be. Particularly here, and I'm probably preaching to the choir in California, a lot of the intellectual property of California's best companies has been ripped off by the Chinese illegally under the World Trade Organization. So the president's made that a point, and I've supported it. All that praise aside, I worry that we are in retreat from our global leadership position in three respects. Number one, NATO and the alliances that we have. He's been an uncertain leader at best. He's failed to honor Article 5. He's not stood up to President Putin on the issue of Russian interference in our elections. We can contain the Russians in a conventional sense, military sense, but now they're using hybrid means to try to weaken us from within, to disrupt our elections, to invade social media, to confuse us. And there's, in my judgment, not been appropriate leadership by the president to deal with that. Number two, I'm a free trader. And what made us really great as an economic power in California, again, Massachusetts, where I come from, we're export states. We became great economies because we had the self-confidence to engage in free trade agreements. And we had, when the president came in, the opportunity for a Trans-Pacific Partnership, 40% of global GDP. It would have united the democratic countries of this part of the world, the Pacific, against China, and the president gave that up. He had the opportunity of a US-EU trade agreement. That's 900 million people. The two largest economies on earth, the EU and the United States, gave that up. So I worry he's dismantling the trade system. And finally, I'd say, if you go to Europe these days, the biggest challenge is this existential challenge of anti-democratic far-right populists like Marine Le Pen in France, trying to subvert democracies. And again, the president has not embraced the small-D Democrats like Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, Theresa May, but people in his administration have embraced Viktor Orban, the Polish government, some of these far-right people, who I think are not, they're not with us, and they don't believe what we believe. So in my judgment, this has been a weak performance, but I do want to say, in saying that, I'm sitting next to someone who I considered an American hero, someone who served his country loyally, and so no reflection on the individuals. I would just leave us at the president's doorstep.
Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, national security is hard. And as we talked earlier today, when I was on the National Security Council staff as a young Navy captain, I had a chance to see how we built the national security strategy and the national strategy for combating terrorism. And on paper, it looked very good, but implementing strategies is hard. And I think what you find in every president's tenure is at some point in time, there is going to be a crisis. And that's when you really find out whether or not the process that the president has put in place, the national security process, works. And in order for it to work, you have to have the right people in place, you have to trust those advisors, you have to have a deep bench. And yet, when you take a look at the fact that we don't have a Secretary of Defense right now, we are cutting the State Department, and you look at some of the key elements of our foreign policy and what we rely on, the intelligence community, the law enforcement community, I think we have to make sure that those processes and those and the right people are in place to advise the president at a point in time when we're going to hit that crisis. As you know, there is a process whereby every president gets briefed, starts at kind of the one star, or the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense or state, when they look at an issue and they bring in the resident experts, the foreign service officers, they bring in the great intel community officers, they begin to develop options for the president, they take that from the planning committees up to the deputies committees, up to the principals committees, and then finally up to the National Security Council. And I know that President Trump does this, but you have to do it frequently enough and you have to make sure the bench is deep enough so that, again, when you hit that crisis, everybody is in place and ready to move and able to provide the president the very best options available to him. We haven't had that crisis yet. So I would just encourage the president to get the right people in place as soon as possible and make sure his bench is deep so that when that time comes, because it will come, he's ready to deal with it.
Nick, let's pick up an issue that Bill raised, which is what's happened with the State Department. I mean, I think it was Jim Mattis who said, if you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition, which basically means that a strong military needs the support of a strong diplomacy as well if we're going to be strong. We've seen the State Department lose about 60% of their career ambassadors. Today, we still have over a third of the ambassadorships are unfulfilled. And in addition, the administration called for a 20% cut at the State Department. What's happening at the State Department now based on your own experience, and what needs to be done to repair the damage?
Mr. Secretary, I'd say that what we needed for us to succeed as a country, we need a strong military, we need strong intelligence services, strong diplomacy in the State Department, and we need good leadership. And when we have that, we're unbeatable. We are the best country in the world. We're the strongest country in the world. Can't neglect the State Department. And your figures are right. In Secretary Tillerson's time, in the first year and a half of the administration, they tried to cut the budget by 31%. The State Department is 8,500 diplomats around the world, staffing 288 embassies and consulates. And we do everything under the sun. We issue the visas for people to come into this country, immigrant visas, non-immigrant visas. We interview refugees. We help American citizens in distress, and there are a lot of them, unfortunately, who need our services. On the policy side, we negotiate the peace agreements for the United States. We help American companies export. And the one thing I learned in my career, we work hand in glove with the United States military. I think we can't succeed unless we're working well. I'm for fully funding the Defense Department. I wouldn't cut a penny off the $750 billion we're spending if you include the two wars. But if you're spending $750 on defense, we're spending $56 billion on the State Department and USAID and all US foreign assistance, a 31% budget cut in 2017 or 21% this year. It's catastrophic. And luckily, the Congress, operating together, Republicans and Democrats, over the last 2 years have restored the funding because I think they do understand you need diplomats to go along with the military and the intelligence services. But what happened in the Trump administration is that a lot of our senior people were either fired or they just resigned in protest because of these budget cuts and because of the inattention. And I really hope, I think the president has a chance here. With a Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who believes in the department, he's a military guy, he had your job as CIA director, he understands the need for this to succeed, and I'm hopeful maybe they'll see a turnaround in the next year or two.
Bill, talking about the Defense Department and our military preparedness, I mean, we are spending now $716 billion on defense. My question is, we've run into a different kind of warfare. I mean, we used to kind of focus on, the wars of the past, but we're now dealing with something called hybrid war. In which the Russians are a good example of that, having used cyber, having deployed personnel without uniforms to the Ukraine to destabilize the Ukraine. And the reality is that doing what they've done without bringing tanks or, you know, fighter planes or bombers, they've actually been pretty successful at destabilizing these countries. Recognizing this new kind of warfare, is the United States prepared to deal with that kind of a new battlefield in the future?
Well, I think we're absolutely prepared to deal with it. I mean, we've looked at asymmetric warfare for a very long time. And when we think about asymmetric warfare, we think exactly about what the Russians are doing, that you have folks that are not in uniform, that folks that are using cyber, that there are different ways that they come at us on the battlefield, and are we man-trained and equipped to deal with that, and I would tell you that I think we are. I think the bigger issue here is almost a strategic one, which is, as you know from your time at Defense, sir, the military sits down and they decide, you know, they recommend to Congress, how are we going to frame the military? What is the military going to look like in the future? And normally when you do that, you look at kind of two approaches. We're going to build a military that addresses the threat, or we're going to build a military that has capabilities. So when you think back in the 80s in the Cold War, we were building a military to go against the Soviet Union. It was bomber versus bomber, submarine versus submarine. That is the way we built the military. And then also the wall falls, and we have this large military that is equipped to deal with major theater wars, but doesn't know how to deal with counterterrorism except for a very small group called Special Operations. And then all of a sudden the military, as great as it is, swings, figures out how to, you know, reorient itself, and then goes to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think as we begin to look at the military writ large, we always have to figure out, from our standpoint, how do we ensure that we have a military that has the flexibility, the capability and the flexibility to adjust to whatever may come our way, recognizing that we might have to fight a major theater war. That means big armies, big navies, big air forces, big Marine Corps. But at the same time, we may have to be dealing with Russians in Ukraine, and do we have the flexibility and the capability to do that? And I think the military is pretty good about thinking through those tough issues and recommending to the Congress the right force for that, Congress and the President.
John, it's an issue that's in the headlines, but you've had some experience with it in all the jobs you've had, which is the whole issue of immigration. After 2 years, of the administration, making immigration obviously a big issue, it would really appear that the situation at the border is worse than ever. Over 100,000 apprehensions in March. DHS seems overwhelmed and stretched. We now don't have a secretary at DHS. We've lost a lot of other positions there. The president has been threatening to send immigrants to sanctuary cities. And
told the Border Patrol officials that if they violate the law, he'll pardon them. Is the situation at the border out of control, and what needs to be done to fix it?
Well, I'd start by saying my last duty assignment before I retired from the Marine Corps, I was the commanding general of United States Southern Command, which has responsibilities for the Caribbean and all of Latin America. And so I have, I'm actually very sympathetic. As I was in the South looking north, I became very sympathetic to the conditions in the countries that most of our the illegal migrants come from. I say I'm sympathetic because much of what their problems are in terms of violence and the like come as a direct result of our drug use in the United States. And it fuels the violence in the conditions that so many of these people are trying to escape. I also am very sympathetic to the people that want to come up here and escape that violence because the economic opportunity is not there. And I would tell you, and I know this to be a fact, and overwhelmingly not, they're overwhelmingly good folks that just want a better life. And they're not all criminals and all MS-13s and the like. So that was my position, and I learned that position when I was on active duty. Taking over DHS, the condition on the border, I mean, we do have laws that have to be enforced. And remember, and I'm very proud of this, I mean, we are a nation of immigrants. This country takes in 1.1 million legal immigrants every year. And those 1.1 million people are set on a course to become citizens of our great country if that's what they want. So the legal immigration is needed and is vibrant and will continue. The illegal immigration along the border is, you know, there's laws that have to be enforced. One of the, you know, the biggest critics of the administration, of course, are the Congress, but they created the laws that are on the books that people like me, law enforcement people, were sworn to uphold. I mean, it's illegal for me to ignore the law. And so in my time at DHS and certainly my time at the White House was to appeal to the Congress to change the loopholes in some of these laws that would, in effect, deter the large numbers of people who are coming up here, first issue. And the second issue, and again, I go back to my time in uniform, I worked very, very, very hard, both in uniform and at the White House, to try to get not foreign aid, but to get investment in those countries, because they're hardworking folks. They generally don't want to leave their countries. That's where their homes are. That's where their families are. So the solution is certainly multifaceted, but in my view, it starts with our you know, doing something about our demand for drugs. It also includes a minimal amount. I mean, there's small economies, you know, small investments go a long way, and at the same time to change some of the loophole laws, because if you change the loophole laws, they'd stop coming because the knowledge now is if you can get into the United States, you can essentially disappear and live here.
John, those of us, there are a few left who worked on immigration reform in the 80s, which was a bipartisan bill. Republicans, Democrats worked to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And everybody, I think, today, whether it's the president or whether it's Democrats or the Republicans on Capitol Hill, everybody agrees comprehensive immigration reform needs to happen. Mm-hmm. So why the hell isn't it happening?
Well,
were you ever close to developing an immigration bill, you know, that might include the Dreamers along with
absolutely. I mean, we were very close on the Dreamers. It broke my heart. We were very close on the Dreamers. And the Congress walked away from it because the pressure, the court got involved, relieved the pressure on the court. We were very close on the Dreamers to include a path to citizenship, which to this day I am still stunned that the POTUS went along with that. But he did. So we were that close. The comprehensive bill, my pitch to Congress was, look, if you don't want to pass the comprehensive bill, which they don't seem to be able to pass, let's start taking individual and have individual passages so that at least we can start to take care of some of the issues. But You know, Congress, you know, Mr. Secretary, you would not recognize Washington, D.C. today from your time. No one wants to work together.
I recognize one of the members.
Yeah. if they work together, one side thinks it's a sellout, the other side sees giving in to the president's desires.
Yeah.
We've got to somehow fix it. It's not working.
Nick, do you have any comments on immigration policies?
Just that I think I support what General Kelly said about legal immigration. From a demographic standpoint, the United States is the second youngest of all the biggest economies in the world. And that gives us an incredible economic advantage. Younger population, more people in the workforce to pay for the older people who are in retirement. So it's India and the United States that are young societies, and Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, and all of Europe are aging. So immigration is a matter of self-interest, but as the general said, we're all immigrants. Everybody in this room has an immigrant story, and so it's part of the fabric. It's a smart thing to do. It's the right thing to do. The only other thing I'll add is that there are 68 million refugees in the world today. Refugees and internally displaced people. It's the greatest number since 1945. And President Obama had us taking in about 70,000 refugees a year. They tend to be very young. They tend to come in families. They tend to be small business creators. And it's interesting, I think all of us would probably recognize this, when I began to swear in our younger officers in the American Foreign Service, there were refugees. There were children of refugees. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're strivers. They get into this country and they want to succeed. And so keeping the doors open for legal immigration and legal refugee admittance, because we know everything about these people when we let them into the country, very important for the strength of the United States.
Talking about Latin America, let me ask about Venezuela, as long as we're on the subject. Obviously, it's another country that's in trouble. And I think many agreed with the president to try to move Maduro out and try to replace him with Guaido. But now we've had the Russians introducing personnel into Venezuela. Maduro is supported by Iran, by China, by Cuba, and nothing seems to be happening right now. Has the policy failed, or where do we go from here on Maduro?
Well, I think the policy is still playing out, so it's not failed. I would tell you, Mr. Secretary, that the countries in Latin America are overwhelmingly positive towards the United States. I mean, Nicaragua, not so much. Cuba, for sure, not. Venezuela, not. But they've joined together, shoulder to shoulder with us. They certainly would not sign up to any type of military intervention. Colombia is doing great things in terms of attempting to relieve they're taking in vast numbers of refugees, housing them, taking care of them in country. Doing it to a large degree at their own expense. They're ready to act, as is Brazil and many of the other countries. And so my view, certainly my argument, would be let them handle it. And I think the policy itself is playing out. He doesn't want to leave.
Maduro.
It'd be great if someone like Cuba would offer him a nice place on the ocean for the rest of his life and we could find an airplane to fly him out. But in the meantime, I think it's playing out, but those people are suffering. I mean, you know, it's a humanitarian crisis, and Maduro and his henchmen don't seem to care. But the good news is Latin America today is overwhelmingly democratic, overwhelmingly prosperous. They have vastly improved human rights records from even just a few years ago, and they want to be associated with the United States as equals, and that's the best way to play this, I think.
Bill, let's talk about the threat from terrorism. You spent your life fighting terrorism, certainly with special forces and the role that they played. The president made the statement that we've defeated ISIS, and clearly we did push him out of the caliphate in Syria and Iraq. But intelligence assessments basically say that ISIS remains a threat. And that ISIS still commands thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria, maintains 8 branches, a dozen networks, and thousands of dispersed supporters. What is your view of ISIS as a threat to the United States, and what is the role of special forces in dealing with them?
Yeah, well, first, you do have to give a lot of credit to President Trump and the pressure that he put on ISIS. It actually began in the Obama administration and then continued on with President Trump, but I would tell you, I think he doubled down on it in a good way, really allowed the military, along with our Kurdish allies and our State Department colleagues and our intelligence community colleagues, to get out there and defeat ISIS. And the Iraqis did a marvelous job in Iraq, pushing them back into Syria. We go into Iraq, take them out of Iraq, and begin to slowly take away their territory to the point where they really have no territory left. But ISIS, a lot like Al-Qaeda, a lot like a lot of these other movements, is partially an ideology. Now, you have to have fighters in order to implement the attacks they want to, but at the end of the day, it is about people believing in whatever the caliphate might be. So you may be able to take away all the territory, but if that ideology is still out there, and it will be, and it may not be ISIS, there may be some other branding. Remember, ISIS started out as Al-Qaeda in Iraq and then morphed into ISIS. It'll morph into something else. I guess what I'd leave you with is that this fight against terrorism is a generational fight. It's not going to go away for a long time. So I can tell you, within the special operations community, over the last couple of years, we have lost 50 or 60 soldiers in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, and other places around the world fighting the global war on terrorism. Those soldiers left behind over 100 children. So anybody that thinks the fight against terrorism is over or going down is mistaken. It isn't. Now, the good news is we are the most capable military, I would tell you, in the history of militaries. In the history of the world, I think we have the finest military in the world, and we certainly have the finest special operations forces. They know how to fight the terrorists that are out there. But the fact of the matter is, this is a long fight. We're going to need our allies. We're going to need our allies in NATO. We're going to need our allies in the Middle East. We're going to need our allies in Asia. And a lot of folks say, well, you just can't keep fighting this fight. We can't be the policemen of the world. Well, the hell we can't. Yeah, we can. We're going to have to, because at the end of the day, they're going to keep coming at us. And, they will come at us in Europe. They will come at us in Asia. They will continue to come at us. So we've got to continue to put our foot on the gas pedal and continue to drive this. Does that mean that more young Americans will die? Unfortunately, I think it does. And does it mean we'll spend billions more to fight this scourge? It does. Is it a fight worth fighting? It is. Because we don't want another 9/11. We don't want to see what happened in Paris come to L.A. or Monterey or anywhere else. So I think we need to continue to fight this, and we've got the right forces to do it.
Let me ask you, and it's something I've been wanting to ask you for a long time. I don't think I ever did. Bill, as I said, ran the operation with the SEALs that went after bin Laden. And he was located in Afghanistan, and I was at CIA headquarters, and we were communicating with each other. What worried you the most about that operation?
You're asking me now?
It's a lot more comfortable now.
I was never really worried whether or not the guys could do the mission. I knew the guys well. We had, as you well know, Ms. Secretary, we had planned this down. We had plan A, plan B, plan C, and plan D. What I didn't know, of course, were the unknowns, which was the compound rigged with demolition? So if you thought about think about these young men that were going into this situation, 24 of them on the ground, our concern, because we couldn't confirm it, was the entire compound rigged with demolition. We saw this a lot in Iraq, we saw it a lot in Afghanistan, and was bin Laden wearing a suicide vest? So you think about the two SEALs that came up on the third deck, they see bin Laden, they realize they've got a mission to do, they move into that room, and there he is standing. Two girls are pushed in front of the first guy coming through. He thinks they have suicide vests on. He moves them out of the way, thinking he's going to save his buddy. because he doesn't know whether or not these young ladies got suicide vests on. And then bin Laden's there, and you don't know whether he has a suicide vest. So it really was the unknown of what was actually inside the compound. All the knowns, the Pakistani defenses, whether my guys could do the job, whether we had the right plans, all that I was okay with. It was the unknowns of what was going on inside the compound, and was there a potential for that entire compound to explode when 24 guys were in there? That was the part that worried me the most.
Yeah, and I think I remember you talking about that.
Yes, sir.
At the time. And let me just ask you, on the backup helicopters with the Chinooks, was that just part of your standard operation?
It was. Again, we had two backup helicopters. Because frankly, the helicopter pilot, we talked about him earlier today, great warrant officer who was flying the Black Hawk that went down, he and I had a number of discussions about the fact that as that helicopter was coming in, there was the potential that somebody could come out of the third floor with a rocket-propelled grenade or begin to engage the helicopter. Now, we had snipers, we had gunners on the door. But he told me, sir, unless I am shot dead right at that moment, I will be able to get that helicopter from there safely into the animal pen, which was the area next to it. I'll be able to get the guys down on the ground safely. And of course, as I was watching on screen, and as you mentioned earlier today, the heat and the prop, actually the blast from the prop created a vortex over the top of the helo. It lost lift, and he careened into the animal pen successfully as the guys moved out. But we knew that was a possibility. So frankly, we had a backup helicopter prepared just in case. And then I had a backup to the backup because we were also potentially going to have to refuel. So when the helicopter went down, one, I knew right away it wasn't a crash. I've crashed a lot of helicopters. And so I knew this was just a hard landing. And of course, I was listening on the radio and watching, and the guys were moving quickly after that. But yes, sir, we had enough backup plans to be able to handle that.
I think the bravery of the SEAL team, plus all of the intelligence, this was a great example of the intelligence community working with the military community on a mission. When I remember at the White House after the president made the announcement, walking out of the White House after the announcement, and there were crowds gathered in both Lafayette Park and on the south side of the White House, and they were yelling, USA, USA, CIA, CIA, which I never thought I would hear. But I think we were really proud because you did send a message to the world that nobody attacks the United States and gets away with it.
Well, thanks, sir.
And thank you for it.
So, if I can just add one point to that. Yeah, I will tell you, we were honored to be the force that got bin Laden, but make no mistake about it. This was hundreds of thousands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, great civilians, great intel community, and law enforcement folks that got us to that point. This was not about one raid in Abbottabad. This was about the global war on terrorism. And when I talk about those helicopters we lost a lot of brave men when those helicopters went down in both Turbine 3-3 and Extortion 1-7 that I remember personally, the number of helicopters we lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's an incredibly tragic event when that happens. You never forget those guys.
Well, we're at the halfway point here, and we're going to turn to the questions from you, the audience. But again, I'd like to take a moment, if I could, to recognize our question review team. These are the people who helped select the questions that will be presented to our speakers. So I'd ask you to hold your applause until I introduce the whole group. Kate Cimini, who is a reporter with the Salinas Californian. David Kellogg, managing editor of the Monterey Herald. Doug McKnight, who is a reporter with KAZU Radio. Paul Miller, who is publisher of the Carmel Pinecone. And Bradley Zee, who is the founding editor and CEO of the Monterey County Weekly. If you would thank them, please. We also have a great group of students representing those who attended the afternoon student program, great afternoon program. At this time, I'd like all of the students in the audience to please stand and remain standing until I identify all of the schools that you represent. There are 10 schools represented this evening.
They are Cabrillo College, Gavilan College, Learning for Life Charter School, Middlebury Institute of International Studies, the Monterey County Office of Education, the Alternative Education Program, Monterey Peninsula College, Navy Postgraduate School, San Jose State University, Santa Clara University, and the University of California at Santa Cruz. Great to have you. The student program, we had a great turnout, and I think everybody here will agree some of the great questions that these students asked were really right on point. The student program is possible because of the generous support of our lecture series sponsors, and Sylvia and I and the Panetta Institute Board of Directors really are very grateful for the sponsorship that allows these students from high schools and colleges, universities, our military installations from throughout the Central Coast to participate. So if you would please give the sponsors a hand, I would appreciate that.